Session number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, Reel 19.
HCF Brewis Reel 19. You'd become adjutant in the November of 1943, Captain Brewis. What exactly were your duties and responsibilities as adjutant?
Well, I had a fair grounding from early infantry days. I'd been in and out of regimental headquarters at various times. I'd done a bit of liaison work between brigade and division and brigade and units in 217 Infantry Brigade. But now it was for real. I'd done it for real for short periods of time when the then adjutant, Jeff Harris, was away on courses or on leave. I had a jolly good orderly room staff. We were maybe a little out of order as far as war establishment was concerned, because Daddy Heslop had a chap called Sam Storm, who progressed through the ranks to be orderly room quartermaster sergeant, who was his personal secretary, really. He dealt with all the confidential and secret correspondence, and of course, after changing over to CDL stuff, his work became more onerous because there was more and more bump connected with CDL exercises and moves, and although he was on my staff, he worked directly with the CO. He became a very good friend of mine. We worked in the same office together. But I had the order room quartermaster sergeant proper. Cost me a bit of a rollicking when he became orderly room quartermaster sergeant, because his move from a colour sergeant to warrant officer was largely on a time basis, and I boobed. He said to me in advance that his 2 years or whatever it was would be up on such and such a date, and I put the promotion through part two orders without mentioning it to the CO. Not that he minded. He wouldn't have stopped the bloke, Colour Sergeant Hitchman's promotion, but he would have liked to have known about it before. I had 1, 2, 3 order room clerks. One of whom was a Hitchman was a good shorthand man as well, and he ran the orderly room. The other one I was mentioning was a damn good typist. He did all these part one and part two orders, and the other fellow, can't remember his name. And I've seen him at reunions since. He was a general all-rounder. Ran the post book and various odds and ends that had to be done, normal routine stuff. And I had Timmy O'Brien, and I've told stories against him on occasion. like another one when he stopped the driver and asked him if he had his accident report, pay book, this, that, and the other, and he couldn't catch him on anything and finished up by saying, have you got your highwayman's code? But apart from things like that, and being non-technical, he was a regular soldier, and he made his way up through the ranks, company sergeant major in the infantry days, and now he was RSM, and he was really on the ball. An instance of that was the very day we finished our move up to Hoddam Castle in Scotland, and we had a fire in the quartermaster stores about tea time of the day. We'd only arrived in the camp, and they wouldn't believe me at the subsequent court of inquiry that the fire orders that I had signed and issued, the fire orders for the new camp, and they were distributed before that fire took place on the very day we'd moved in. But as well as questioning me and the guard commander, the regimental police, they all confirmed it, and that was Timmy O'Brien. He had it out, and he had it for me to, what the heck do you call it, the thing he used on a Ronio, you know, the stencil. He had shoved it in front of me, and I was, well, he signs that fire orders. That was typical of him. Got me, well, I was absolutely covered through him being right on the ball. So that's the staff side. What were the duties of an adjutant? First of all, and primarily, to do what I wasn't able to do for a variety of reasons, and that was to get out and about and be seen out and about in the unit. And although there was only 5'6" of me and about 9 stone at the most, I would have loved to have been able to get out and just ask a few pertinent questions here and there, just to keep them on their toes. And what stopped me? Well, it was the load of bump that was flying around. These sort of orders, part one and part two orders, had to be issued as a matter of routine.
What was the distinction between part one and part two orders?
Part two orders were promotions, demotions, grants of leave, what else? Very routine things concerning I boomed once as well. I had the padre in, very mild mannered man, Father Coonan, his Roman Catholic padre, was with us all the time, right from Hartlepool. Sergeant Hitchman said he'd had a bod in who wanted to change his religion from RC to CV. Could he go ahead and put it through part two orders, change of religion? I said, well, if that's what he wants, better have him in. Had a word with him. I didn't have a word with the padre, the RC padre. Oh, dear me. He was wild. one of his flock had escaped. So even such a simple thing as part two orders on those two occasions could get one into deep water. Part one orders. Well, I've got the one here that the order of the day when Derry Heslop gave up command. This is what it said for that particular day. Blackout time for the night 4th to 5th September 2029 at 05:57 and for the next day. Mentioning the name of Trooper Gibson A Squadron, who'd been selected as the commander's stick orderly on the guard the previous night. Nominating A Squadron as the duty squadron for week ending 11th of September. In other words, the potato peelers and the fatigues had to be found from that squadron that week. Other duties, captain of the week from 0600 the 6th of September to 0600 the 13th, Captain N.J. Norman Squiddle. Regimental orderly officer, 5th of September, the following day, Captain R.W. Southern, Dickie Southern, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, next for duty, so that they got plenty of warning. Similarly, Regimental Orderly Sergeant, SSM Smales, A Squadron, and the next three. And the final item that day, because obviously Daddy Heslop wasn't too sure of J.B. Robertson's religious leanings or views, divine service. Regimental Order 205. Oh, this was Regimental Order number 209 in sequence. Regimental Order 205/10, dated the 31st of August 43, regarding parade services to be held on Sunday, the 5th of September 43, is hereby cancelled. Officers commanding squadrons. Sometimes they called themselves squadron commanders. Somebody had the temerity to refer to himself as a squadron leader. It was Tudor. You're not in the RAF. But this was the way officers commanding squadrons will give all facilities to any men who wish, lovely split infinitive, to voluntarily attend any of the services mentioned therein. That was a short one. Among the vast quantities of paper, there would be orders emanating from brigade headquarters, usually from a staff captain. He liked to do as much as he could, either by, if it was a general thing, supplementing the paper with calling in the three adjutants to go and see him. He very rarely came and saw us. On odd occasion he did.
Just still the same brigadier?
Yeah, Lipscomb. Yeah. Same staff captain, chap called Louis Tarlow. He figured as an international bridge player after the war. The brigade major was Oxenbuck Slate Infantry, but I can't remember his name. I can see him, but I can't remember his name. But as well as what was coming from brigade, not a lot seemed to come from 79th Armoured Division. I think it was the benefit of geography. There were things that came through brigade and were funneled out from there. But there were regular command orders. And these came in the form of properly printed sheets. We were in Western Command. Headquarters in guesswork, Manchester, Liverpool, somewhere like that. And these were about, well, the divisional commander's wishes in respect of A, B, C, could be anything under the sun. Varied with the divisional commander's pet likes and hates. Courses available, inevitably. Oh, all sorts of things.
And to deal with the regimental role.
Sorry?
Regimental role, were you involved in that? Keeping that up to date?
Yes, this sort of thing. This was another thing that that was taken on that I got to, well, he'd done it before under Jeff Harris, but Timmy O'Brien, the RSM, used to report the state of affairs, you know, how many were fit for duty every day, how many were sick, how many were on leave, how many were away on courses, which went to the field, the daily parade state, it was called.
Did you have a disciplinary role?
Yeah, but let me just finish off on the paperwork. What we used to do with these, we had a big stamp made with the names of the various people, obviously the second in command, the squadron commanders or officers commanding squadrons, the quartermaster, the MO, the PRI, president of the Regimental Institute. And these orders were circulated, and last name to return to order room. And this more or less covered all eventualities. And if there was nothing in, I mean, just common sense, if there was nothing that would interest the MO, quite often it would interest the quartermaster. He was just struck through, and it went in sequence. And if they got a bit lax in getting them back within a reasonable sort of time, then I got into the habit of slapping a return by date on it. If it was something that I thought going through them, and these things came with ever increasing monotonous regularity, sometimes it got very difficult to cope with all the bump and try and do the other side, the outside work as well. It got less and less. I'd got into habit in Daddy Heslop's time. If he came across something which he wanted to know more about, he would just write, "Adjutant, speak." So I got in the habit of reversing that and forestalling him. And if I saw something that might be a bit controversial, did he want anything done about that? How did he want to do this, that, and the other? And I just would sideline it and say, "We'll speak." And that and all the regular stuff went into him, went into the CO early each morning. And depending on the quantity, sometimes individual items would get slung back for immediate action and or immediate pushing out to an individual who was more directly concerned. Otherwise, he would go through that, and I'd get the whole basket full back again in due course. And that would be interrupted by CO's orders. If on up on a charge of some misdemeanor, which the his squadron commander couldn't deal with personally, and was remanded for CO's orders. Then I had to be. I didn't need do anything more than be present, because Timmy O'Brien had organised it all behind the scenes. He's a great helper. I'll show you afterwards what he gave me on my 25th birthday. The other thing which cut into the time for dealing with the paper, and which sometimes meant even, I was going to say, a lot of evening work, sometimes meant a lot of late nights. I remember one time at Hoddam, after Colonel Robertson left, Lee Criddle, who was our second in command, was filling in between him leaving and the next CO being appointed. And long after I should have been in bed, he'd seen the light on and came around to see what's what. Found me asleep over the desk. But what used to cut into the into dealing with the paperwork was going up with the CO, either on doing exercise on the training area during the day, or occasionally at night, because he wanted to know what was going on, wanted to be very much involved, had to be, get awkward questions from the brigadier that he had to be able to answer. And that, and getting down to the real stuff of being on, when we got on from squadron training on to regimental exercises, when as adjutant I had to be the wireless link between the CO, codename Sunray, and B echelon, the soft-skinned vehicles, under the command of the second in command. And when the brigadier sort of turns up at my tank on occasion, said the CO's tank's just brewed up. What are you going to do?
In the action situation, as adjutant, you'd have had your own tank.
Named Yip. CO's was Inkerman. That it would be with Inkerman, DLI. Somewhere, I can look it up if it's of any interest, of how the tanks and the scout cars were named, but I'd have to need notice of that question. Whether it is of interest or not, I don't know. So, the CEO was gone, so it was a question of getting the senior squadron commander to fill the breach until the second in command could hand over B echelon initially to either the RSM or the quartermaster, until he could come in and take over whatever tank there was available. If he would kick the nearest available one out and take it over himself. That was on realistic exercise. That's another aspect of the job.
Did you have much in the way of problems with men who were breaking regulations or rules in the unit?
Oh, a fair crop of defaulters.
What kind of problem were they creating?
Well, I suppose the most frequent one was overstaying leave. Those who had come from any distance, of course, had the wonderful excuse that they were coming by train, but there'd been bombing or a derailment or this, that, and the other. And it was difficult to disprove. There were a few who were charged with desertion. Not a lot, as I remember. But then they were, if there was evidence to prove a willful intention and evidence to show that hidden themselves away and had to be chased out by the military police. Well, then of course it went out of the CO's hands and went to court martial. In which case, I was involved with the preliminary paperwork, but it was largely a question of presenting the case to brigade headquarters, and then they would get on and organise an independent court martial, either from the other units in the brigade or, if it was something very serious, from outside through division.
Being a unit which had been in operation now for quite a while, and as you say, the training was reaching a pretty high pitch, was there a problem coming of boredom, an ongoing problem of boredom with men who were really pretty well tuned into their work?
Well, I hinted at that after coming back from Lenny Head in the autumn of 43. But no, we were looking ahead to D-Day. I kept wondering what the sealed envelope I had in my safe, marked top secret, not to be opened until the commencement of hostilities on the continent. It was, no, the anticipation of our use. It was never down on paper, even for the CO's eyes only. But the general feeling was, and it wasn't just a rumour, that we were going to be used to light up the beaches at a very early stage. Then it was pointed out that even although the lights were very difficult to range on, and whatever happened to the beam, either with different coloured filters or with the scatter mechanism in operation, I could pinpoint the reflection on the water. But we had chief medical officer of the division up talking in a very straightforward manner about casualties in tanks, the ever-present danger of fire, the practicalities of getting casualties out of tanks. That was only one little illustration of how minds were being prepared and We had no idea more than anybody else when it was coming, but we were in the spring of, coming into the spring of 44, and there was a great deal of clamour for the opening of the Second Front, not only by Joe Stalin, but in many quarters. No, I don't think anybody had a chance to be bored very much. The state of the camp was vastly improved. By now, everybody was quartered in huts. Didn't have to tramp through the mud. There were proper pathways laid. And although there was censorship, there was a reasonable amount of privilege leave granted. And then April, all privilege leave was cancelled. Oh, well, this is the start of it, you know. But that didn't last for long. 21st of April, the axe fell. Out of Lowther Camp to Hoddam Castle in Scotland, in Dumfriesshire. 35th Tank Brigade out of 79th Armoured Division, out of 21st Army Group.